downstairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Hi everyone, welcome back to Thorough Box. It is Sunday, the 23rd of December, two more days till Christmas, and I have a gift for you, finally keeping my promise of the last few months. We have recorded the first installment of the interview with Simon Templar. So he and I got on the phone, and we talked for well over an hour, but I've edited it down to about 55 minutes for everyone, so I hope it is informative, beneficial, and maybe even slightly enjoyable. Thanks for listening in advance. Let's roll. Well, again, thank you all for listening. I am on the line with Simon Templar, or ST. ST, thanks very much for your time and for preparing for this. I've been thinking for a while it'd be worth it for listeners and readers to actually hear from you, and I think it makes a big difference to people to be able to hear the voice or see the face of people who are affected in these sorts of situations. So
you're welcome.
Get a little bit closer to the audience if they can hear your voice. So
You're welcome, and I agree with you, and I hope that what is said is constructive and helpful for people who find themselves in situations of conflict. So
yeah, that's a good point, because when we get to the later questions, that'll be one of the issues we'll discuss, is what we want to get out of the blog, out of having these conversations, and out of continuing to talk about and publish what's gone on in this situation. So not only to get the truth out there, but to, Lord willing, have something constructive come out of it.
Right. So. Exactly.
All right. So first we'll take our listeners back 3 years. Let's go back in time to late 2015, October, November, December. What do you think were the main turning points in the unfolding of events, or which decisions that people involved made? Which decisions did the most harm?
I think, let me just go in order. The first issue had to do with bringing in a man from the denomination to serve as a consultant, to help with a visioning process.
Mm-hmm.
So he was brought in the winter of 2015. I contacted him, I believe it was January of 2015, because some in the congregation had expressed interest in doing an internal church survey. And I realized that the denomination had materials and resources for that purpose, and that to do it on a do-it-yourself basis could be counterproductive. If you don't know what you're doing, if you don't know how to interpret the results of the survey, or if you don't have a follow-up plan,
mm-hmm.
once you have the congregation take the survey, then you can cause even more frustration, because then the congregation says, well, you took the survey 6 months ago and, you know, nothing's happening with it.
So yeah, you need to know what you're going to do with the results.
Exactly. So I felt it was really important to get somebody to help us who knew how to do this. And like I said, the denomination had the resources. So I contacted this denominational employee. He was listed in the home missions department, and his job description was as a coach, a consultant, and so forth. So I brought him in. I asked him to speak to our council and talk about this process of doing a church survey. And he said that we weren't at that point, and he recommended that the council do church visits, that the elders and the deacons form three teams, and that they visit all of the people in the congregation to get the pulse of the congregation. Now, I say he was really one of the first problems, or one of the first harmful decisions, because he had a conflict of interest. He knew the church too well. I did not know what his previous involvement had been in the church and the community, but years before, he had been an elder in our church. He had been on the council. He actually grew up in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And so his knowledge of the church and his roots were such that he should not have been involved. He couldn't be objective in his help with us assessing the church. And in addition to that, he even had some relatives in the church who, mm-hmm. it turns out, were some of the people who were disgruntled and had issues with me. And I found out later that he had been talking to them. So the fact that he had a clear conflict of interest he even acknowledged this 6 months after he first met with us. So that's the first problem with this guy. I mean, this was a significant turning point or issue was his involvement. The second thing was that he met secretly with the elder who had wanted to get rid of me prior to my termination. He met with that elder secretly in his home about 10 weeks before his follow-up meeting with the council, which was, it was early September of 2015. So about 7 weeks, I think, before I was suspended, he met with the whole council to discuss the report of the church visitors and the elder visitors, the congregational visits, and how that went.
Okay. So just to clarify, so his secret meeting at the elder's home was before the visits by the elders was actually completed. Was that sometime in June?
Yeah, that was about the end of June. And I think by then they had just about wrapped up all of the visits to the members of the congregation.
Okay.
So he met with this elder secretly in the elder's home, and it was about 10 weeks prior to his follow-up meeting with the whole council.
Okay.
So a little over 2 months later, he met with all of us. But the fact that he met with that elder secretly, that was untoward. The other two elders, when they found out about it, they weren't happy about it. They both expressed their irritation with the fact that this elder had met with him. And even that Stan Custer, who's this denominational guy, that he agreed to meet with them secretly.
Why was that inappropriate?
Well, on the face of it, the fact that it was done in secret aroused a suspicion. I mean, if it was appropriate to do, then why not be upfront and tell everybody about it? So just the fact that you're doing it under the table is problematic. We don't know what they talked about. And if there were allegations against me, I never had a chance to respond. And of course, I had met with Stan sometime in July as a precursor to having the meeting with him in September. Talk about putting that together. And he never mentioned that he met secretly with this elder.
I see.
Mm-hmm. So then another thing that he did that I believe was unhelpful is he interviewed the elder deacon teams. There were three of them who visited the congregation in that spring and summer, and he wrote up the results of his interviews with those teams, and his write-up was distorted because his portrayal was one of very general disaffection on the part of the members.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't the case at all, because two of the elders told me that their visits went well. They had almost no complaints. The complaints that people registered were very minor things, like the preference of the hymnals and that sort of thing. So two of the elders were very clear that the visits went well. They were positive. People had very few complaints or problems. It was the third elder deacon team that had the complainers and that had people who were disaffected and had issues. But Stan's report was overall negative. So it's like his report distorted the picture of the visits.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we never got to see or discuss those visits. I never had a follow-up discussion with Stan about the visits or why his report was weighted so negatively in comparison to the report that I got from the other two elders.
Right.
So yeah. that was unhelpful. And then when we had our meeting in early September, we had that meeting with the full council to talk about how to go forward after having done the visits and so forth. He made a very inappropriate comment when he informed the council that they were in charge and that I worked for them. I'm not sure how that came up in the conversation, but he wanted to reinforce their position or suggest to them that they had some authority that they weren't aware they had or something like that. But he was clear that they were in charge, and he said, looking around the table to all of them, he works for you, meaning me.
Mm-hmm. Why was that problematic?
Well, it was a dangerous thing to say. Well, for a couple of reasons. First of all, that's really not true. The pastor doesn't work for the council. The pastor is held accountable by the council.
Mm-hmm.
There's an appropriate system of checks and balances. But to say that the pastor works for the council is really wrongheaded, because if you think about it, the pastor has to view himself as working for God, not doing what the council tells him to do.
Right.
So there's an imbalance. There's a wrong-headed notion if you think that the council should tell the pastor what he can and cannot preach. In fact, it's funny that a year before we had a discussion in the council about that, and the mind of the council was that it's inappropriate to say to the pastor that certain subjects are off limits.
Right. And of course, by late summer of 2015, there's been quite a shift.
Yeah, by then half the council had turned over.
Mm-hmm.
But we had had a couple in 2014, we had had a couple that was objecting to continuationism with the doctrine that the gifts of the Spirit in 1 Corinthians 12 continue to operate in the church. That is the position, the official position of the Christian Reformed Church, is that the gifts of the Spirit still operate as they did in Acts and in 1 Corinthians 12. And I was affirming that position and had actually taught some lessons to that effect. And there was a couple that didn't like that, and they were saying that to be Reformed means you have to be a cessationist. So they wrote a letter to the council expressing that, and that's what gave rise to our discussion about who decides what the pastor preaches and how should that go.
Yeah.
And there was a consensus around the table that there's just something untoward about the council or the church saying, well, you can't preach on that, or, you know, we'll decide what you can and can't preach.
Mm-hmm.
So they are, the council, according to the church order, is to monitor the pastor's doctrine and life. And so they're to make sure that the sermons are biblical, that they're doctrinally appropriate, and even that there's balance. Like if I was always preaching out of Revelation, they would have a right to say that that's not balanced. And, you know, we should also have some Old Testament texts, you know, that would be appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
But to say things are off limits, again, there was the general consensus that just was not appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one piece of it. And then the other reason why it was inappropriate is Stan was not knowledgeable. He wasn't aware of what was going on. And if you have people on a council who are in the flesh or who have wrong-headed ideas about how it should go, or even in the case of Elder 13,
right,
you had an ambitious, strong-willed elder who had issues with authority.
Mm-hmm. He was loading his gun for him.
Yeah, and he was disaffected with me. He wanted to get rid of me. So to say he works for you was the wrong thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
That was empowering to him and enabled him to get revved up even more to get rid of me. That was like giving him the green light to say, you guys have the power to hire and fire this guy.
Right.
So just an inappropriate comment, mindset.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's not all. As far as Stan Custer, he even handpicked the church visitors when he talked about the need to bring church visitors in at that point because of, he said that this is where we are now as a result of the congregational visit. There's unrest and there's people that are disgruntled. And so now we have to bring in church visitors to get to the bottom of this or whatever, however you put it. But he handpicked the church visitors by name. He recommended these two guys. And that was unwise because he didn't reflect on the size of the churches and on who as a church visitor would be appropriate for us based on ministry context. So that was a problem. And he also knew that there were problems with the practice of church visiting across the denomination.
Right.
You had actually written a response to, it was a lengthy paper, a white paper,
mm-hmm,
that this committee did. What was the title of that white paper?
Oh, it was called the Church Visitors Pilot Project, Church Visiting Pilot Project, and it was a review of the process and how it was working out, how the procedures were working out in practice and what the pitfalls were, and some recommendations for improvement.
Right.
And he was a co-author of this report, which was already in the works by the time he was involved at Aetna, and I think it was finally published in late summer of 2016, maybe, but they were already working on it. They'd completed their field research by the summer of 2015.
And it was a committee of like three or four people, wasn't it? And he was one of the committee?
Yes.
Yeah. And so they acknowledge, it's been a while since I read that report, but they openly acknowledge problems with the structure, with the practice. This was a denomination-wide problem.
Mm-hmm.
And there was acknowledgement that people didn't know how to do it, what the purpose was. They didn't have a game plan when they set about to do it.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't trained to do it. And so it was acknowledged that it was a problem and that there were pitfalls involved in conducting it and doing it. There was fallout and there were consequences of handling church visiting badly.
Yeah.
Or maybe if not badly, inadequately, being inadequately prepared for it.
Right.
So in the light of this understanding that it was a problem, people weren't trained, it wasn't working well, he wants to go ahead and do it anyway. So I do not believe that it's overstating it to say that he blew it. He shouldn't have been involved. He acknowledged it at that meeting. He said, I shouldn't even be here. And he had some other comment, I don't remember, but he acknowledged that there was a conflict of interest and he shouldn't have even been involved in helping us. It should have been somebody else. His actions were harmful to me and to the church.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, once I was terminated, there were people who knew of his involvement and approached him. Some wrote, there were a couple people who wrote letters to him.
Mm-hmm.
He was approached. I think he was approached by at least a couple of people. One of them I remember distinctly approached him in a restaurant and really went after him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he knew that he caused offense and that he was manipulated by this problem elder. And yet even after all of that, in fact, you contacted him too.
Yeah.
You wrote him a letter in the context of that study committee of, what was it? Not Better Together. What was it? The pilot program or pilot something or other?
Church Visitors Pilot Project. Better Together might have been the main title.
Yeah, that was the main focus of the project. And then the pilot thing that they did was kind of like an adjunct to that.
Yeah.
But you wrote him about that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what I say in light of all of that, knowing that I was terminated, knowing that it ended badly, people wrote him, complained, people confronted him, you wrote him. He never made any attempt to contact me.
Mom, he's not unique in that respect.
And so that bothers me because here you've got a denominational employee, an elder in a church, a longtime believer. He knows that there are issues, then he never attempts to contact me. That bothers me, frankly.
That's reasonable. I wonder, mm-hmm. though, I was reflecting on the fact that just in these 20 minutes talking about just Stan's involvement, you can trace the consequences of the meetings or the events in which he was involved, the report, and an offhand comment. Well, from his perspective, it may very well have been offhand to say that you work for the council, you work for the elders. I'm not sure he ever took any of this that seriously. He was going through the motions, but we see now the domino effect and how critical each of these little things was in terms of bringing about the next link in the chain.
Mm-hmm.
But because he wasn't taking it or you all that seriously at the time, I'm not sure after the fact, even though he got the Irish up of several people who contacted him, I'm not sure he realizes now the seriousness of his actions or the consequences of them, because he was never mm-hmm. that invested in the first place. He was just winging it and throwing his weight around.
Right. Yeah, when you think about it objectively, especially if you've got some years under your belt, you know that there are people with issues, even people with pathologies, and there are certain things you ought not to encourage them to do, which he unwittingly did by saying he works for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're the boss of this guy. You should be pulling his strings. He's not the leader of this church. You know, you tell him what to do. Now, of course, I'm embellishing it, but that could be an inference that somebody with issues might draw.
Right. I'll take it and run with it.
He's supposed to dance. Yeah, he's supposed to dance our dance. And if he doesn't do what we tell him to do, we can get rid of him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very unwise. Yeah. And the second big turning point after Stan Koster and his involvement was the calling in of the church visitors. Mm-hmm. They weren't helpful. One of them was new to the area. He wasn't even a CRC pastor. So it's dubious that he should be brought in. In fact, when I described this to other colleagues, other ministers, other elders, I usually get a reaction. You're like, huh? Or why did they do that? So that was a problem. And they both of the church visitors pastored churches that were significantly different from our local church, just in terms of their size alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, churches substantially bigger with multi-staff and all of that, whereas ours was a small country church with one staff person.
Right.
Me. So,
yeah.
And of course, we already talked about how the denomination acknowledged problems with the church visiting model.
Mm-hmm.
So it shouldn't be surprised that they weren't prepared or they weren't equipped to come in and mediate or troubleshoot. And they weren't. And what's worse yet is that the more influential of the church visitors, not the guy from the different denomination, he probably, his involvement was probably 10-20% max.
Mm-hmm.
The other guy did most of the talking and had most of the sway and the influence, but he had been listening to criticisms of me several months prior to being called in as a church visitor.
You mean the more influential one?
Yeah,
Manus.
That's Keith Manus. He's mm-hmm. been mentioned on your blog, and so he's one of the few whose names has actually been publicized.
Right.
Think of the old Dragnet series, you know, the names have been changed to protect the innocent. So he actually has a name, not a number. But yeah, Keith had been listening to criticisms of me several months prior to being pulled into our situation. And I got that from a colleague where I pastored. One of my colleagues said that Keith mentioned to him that I had better make some changes or I'd be in trouble or something to that effect. So he was hearing things. This was in June when I got this report. So several months prior, he had already been hearing things. And there's no doubt in my mind that he had been talking not only to detractors in general, but I think he'd been talking to number 13. But whatever the case, he was not objective when he came into our situation.
Well, he'd been talking or hearing criticism from someone before he was called in, but you didn't find out about what he was saying until after he was involved. Is that right?
I'm not even sure if I got the specifics on what he had been told, just that he had been told, he acknowledged that he had been told some things.
Right.
Or he didn't deny it, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
I mean, right around the time that I received my Article 17 termination papers, I think it was the day before that meeting, I sent him a really long, like a 4-page letter explaining all of the problems with the processes that unfolded and his part in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I called him on several things that he did wrong or that he misrepresented, even things that were integrity issues.
Mm-hmm.
And he never acknowledged them, never addressed my concerns. But his silence, when more than once I had mentioned that he had heard things about me, his silence indicated to me that in fact had happened. And of course, like I said, I heard about this from a colleague. A colleague told him at a meeting that I had better make some changes or better do something because I was going to be in trouble if I didn't, you know. So.
Right.
And then, of course, the role of the church visitors is to mediate and to try to make sure that the parties are talking. They're to come in and make sure that the council and the pastor are communicating and talking and to try to encourage forward progress and discussion and communication. So they're not mediators. I mean, they don't arbitrate. They do serve somewhat of a mediatorial role according to the church order, but they didn't try to bring about reconciliation or discussion. They never met with me to discuss issues or to determine if criticisms about my conduct were valid. And in fact, they only met with me one time.
Mm-hmm.
And in that one meeting, the vast majority of the time of our meeting, which was about a half hour, we talked about my life journey. Very little was discussed about the church or what was going on. So we have our one meeting, then there's a time lag, then they have a handful of meetings with the council, and then the next thing I know, I'm suspended. So as one of the parishioners who supported me said in a very scathing letter to them, this parishioner said there was no fact finding, no investigating, and that these visitors really just operated as partisans on behalf of the council.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's overstating it to say that they took sides, which is inappropriate.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and I've wondered, so there was the very likely possibility that Keith Manis came in predisposed to take a critical view of you. But we've talked mm-hmm. several times over the years about this, not necessarily American, but very democratic predisposition to prefer or side with an apparent majority against a minority or against a one.
Right.
There's a suspicion of the single or smaller group counter to the larger group
yeah.
who must somehow be right or have a better handle on either reality or reason.
Right. There are several significant factors at play. One of them is the assumption that I know these people, this is a good church, they're supportive in the community, they support the Christian school, and they're saying X, Y, Z, so therefore they have to be right, or it has to be true.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Proverbs, I think it's Proverbs 18:7. Ah, here it is. It's 18:17, not 18:7. The one who states his case first seems right until the other comes and examines him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, think about that. The one who states his case first seems right until the other comes and examines him. And that's just a truism in life. You know, until you hear the other side, you almost have to tell yourself, now, wait a minute, I'm only getting this from one side. I'm only hearing one side of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us were brought up that way. You know, we were brought up. My mother was big on that, you know, to be really careful about hearing just one side without letting the other person say or, you know, tell their version. So
mm-hmm.
so you've got that. That's at play. Assumptions about the people. You think you know them. You think they're pillars in the community and they wouldn't lie. And then, like you said, the idea that truth is decided by majority opinion,
mm-hmm.
which is certainly fallacious. You know, we don't decide truth by majority opinion. I mean, think of the discoveries in science, you know, scientific advancement. Many times the majority was dead set against what this particular scientist said was reality.
Well, and in church history as well, especially in the early mm-hmm. church in the time of the Reformation, some of these guys were standing alone, and most of us Protestants nowadays would side with them, but we don't know what it was like to have been Athanasius or Martin Luther
sure.
or anybody else trying to stand against the tide of heresy or softness. But there seems to be this suspicion now or presupposition in the church that if you go in and the pastor's standing on one side and it seems everyone else is on the other, he must be some sort of a tyrant.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not, people aren't encouraged to take any time to investigate what the issues are, what the disagreements are. And if it is a doctrinal disagreement, wonder about why the person who has the actual training is being opposed. And you have to look at it carefully.
Well, it at least requires investigation. I mean, on the face of it, it requires investigation. But yeah, like you said, this underlying assumption that if there's that many people that say it, well, they must be right. Well, that's nonsense.
And of course, we know that there was even a secret ally on the council itself and people in the congregation who didn't agree with the most vociferous critics on the council and in the church of you. Those people were there. And they wanted to be heard, but the church visitors weren't interested.
Right, there's that. And in fact, what I was going to say when you described, you know, what happened in church history with majority versus minority, numerically, that wasn't even in the case at my church,
mm-hmm.
at our church.
Right, it wasn't you against all of Aetna.
No, it wasn't a majority at all. It was a vocal minority.
Mm-hmm.
There were some disgruntled people. There were some people that had issues. But if they had taken the pulse of the congregation, they would have found a number of people in the middle who didn't even know there was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
They would have found a significant segment who were in strong disagreement with the detractors.
Mm-hmm. But this is where Stan's report probably had quite a
a negative impact.
Right.
Because if that was supposed to be one of their primary source readings,
right,
their sort
right.
of initial homework, plus what they'd heard from 13, then that's the impression they would have, is that
right.
the church in general was making these complaints.
Right, and that's why one of the consequences of his distorted, inaccurate report.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, so they did no fact-finding or investigating, and they treated me as if those allegations were true.
From the beginning.
And that was clear in the meetings that we did have together, their demeanor, their approach, you know, just things that are said, you know, like, well, okay, are you willing to make some changes? You know, so the implication, of course, behind that is that I'm the one with the problem and I have to make adjustments.
Well, even before that, there's the implication that they know what the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's right. been defined.
Right. It's not the first thing should be, well, these allegations or these are people with complaints or beef. Let's find out if they're true or if there's anything to it. We skipped over that and mm-hmm. assumed that that's all true. And it's okay. Now, what are you going to do to make them happy or to correct your mistakes?
Right.
mm-hmm. Yeah. So in the end, I guess we're wrapping up this first question now. In the end, what these visitors did was they supported the council's decision in a suspension. And when they suspended me on October 27, that was a baseless and a groundless suspension, which they collaborated in or gave guidance to the council about. And it was both baseless and groundless. And I'm not being redundant. When I say baseless, I mean there really wasn't a good reason for it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like I had committed some offense or they had to get me out of there or I needed to be monitored for a time. So there was no real good reason for it. And when I say groundless, I mean there was no grounding for it in the church order. There was no way that they could justify suspending me because you're supposed to have, I can't remember, I'm shooting from the hip here, but there has to be a doctrinal or a moral or some other issue, and it also has to have the concurrence of a local council.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't do any of that.
Well, they didn't even try. Probably inspired by Stan's exhortation to make sure that you knew that you worked for them. They were more than happy to boot you out without giving you reason.
Yeah, well, that's an inference, even if it's not a valid inference, but that's an inference, is that, well, he works for us, we can do what we want.
Mm-hmm.
Right, well, you don't even have that in the business world. But
right, I was just going to say, I'm not sure that's even allowed under secular employment law.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But that's kind of the drift you can take. If, well, I'm in charge, you answer to me. Mm-hmm. And what do I have to worry about, church order? I want to suspend you for 3 weeks, I'll do it.
Well, and the sequence of events and the way the group conversation had been going over the past several months, the people who were in the middle of the storm would have been under the impression that they were coming to this crisis point. And even though it was a false crisis in many ways, the way it was being treated by the professionals, of course, they didn't know that it was necessary that they consult the church order or that they get approval or that they have grounds. They were being encouraged in their ignorance and in their haste, but also were being propagandized on several sides that this was such a critical problem and something had to be done for the future of the church.
Exactly. Number 13 was ginning up the drama. In fact, one of the elders told me on more than one occasion that 13 would call him, and every time he would call him, he would talk about how dramatic he sounded and like he was building this up, like really blowing it out of proportion.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're in crisis mode or it's panic time, that kind of thing. And of course, I didn't see it that way at all. But, you know, in looking back now, he was trying to buttress up his case, I guess.
Right. And I think, I mean, we're not psychologists. We've played amateur psychologists a lot. But if the man does have a pathology or he was going through some sort of strange phase, I think he was trying to keep his own energy levels up, you know, keeping himself excited. Anyway, I guess that leads us to that date. I mean, we've talked about the turning points, the first set of dominoes, and then we get the first sort of big documentary date, October 27th of 2015. Sorry. Walk us through the meeting of that night, and then also, if we have time, the sequel to it, the shorter meeting on November 5th.
Yeah, well, that night I came to the meeting. It was a regularly scheduled council meeting. So it's the end of the month. And 3 weeks prior to that, the council had given to me a list of recommendations or suggestions or ideas. It varied depending on the conversation, but there were recommendations, suggestions that they wanted me to do. And there were six of them on this list. And they presented them to me 3 weeks before, which would have been October 6th. And my understanding was that they wanted me to respond to those questions, and I thought it was supposed to be each one. I was supposed to provide an answer or a response to each one. And that night, I told them, well, I can't just decide or answer this now. You know, I'd like some time to think about it. So they gave me 3 weeks, and then I came to that meeting with my response. And I had written it out. It was probably 3 or 4 pages in length. And each one, I responded to each one of their suggestions. And I also had a preamble of sorts, you know, to introduce the suggestions. But anyway, as the meeting began, I was surprised that the church visitors were present. I wasn't told that they were going to be there, but they were. And then number 13 acknowledged that he invited them, and he forgot to tell everybody that they were going to be there. So,
had you expected? Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I found it offensive, and I was taken by surprise for it. I did not like it. I thought it was manipulative. And some of the other council members, as I remember, were not too pleased that all of a sudden we show up and the church visitors are there, and that he hadn't told anybody. But they were there at 13's invitation.
Right, and you had expected this to be a conversation between you and the council, since the council had drawn up the list of suggestions.
Right, right. And so my initial reaction was, what are they doing here?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think I said it quite that way, but that was certainly one of the first thoughts that crossed my mind is, why are they here? Mm-hmm. What are they going to do? So as the meeting began, I told them that I had a response and I wanted to read it, and there was pushback. There was resistance to me reading my response, and they wanted to make an issue out of it. And number 13 said, well, it's just a yes or no. Are you going to do it or not? And I said, well, that's not the way I remember it 3 weeks ago. I don't recall you presenting it to me that you just want a yes or no answer, that it's a blanket deal. So then Keith Manis weighed in and sort of reiterated what 13 said, well, they don't want you to read it. And I said, no, come on. I've taken the time to read this. Why can't I? I've taken the time to write this up. Why can't I read my responses?
Right, especially since...
Sorry, ahead.
I shouldn't interrupt. I was just going to say, just to note that these six different things, a lot of them aren't even related issues. They're quite disparate, drawn from different parts of church life or ministry. And you were supposed to take it seriously. So a written response interacting with each one was evidence that you were thinking about it, praying about it, taking it seriously. And
Right. They
clearly weren't receptive to that.
Right, right. But I mean, just the heavy-handed, dictatorial tone that takes on. Well, we're not going to let you read that. No, wait a minute. You know, it's not going to take that long out of your busy schedule for me to read this, and I want to do it. Why would you try to stop? Why would you make an issue out of this? Why would you argue this point? And so we wrangled about it between 5 and 10 minutes, and finally they agreed to let me read it. In fact, number 13 actually went around the table, almost like polling the jury, and he goes around the table and asks each of the council members, was your understanding that he was to just say yes or no to all of it or not? So he goes around and asks each individual council member. And of course, my reaction to that is, that's irrelevant. You know, the way I understood it, or the way it was presented to me, was not that I had to just give a yes or no answer and that's it.
Mm-hmm. So, well, and what's reasonable and what's productive.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, the suggestions or the recommendations were not well written. They weren't clear. I was not allowed to discuss them 3 weeks before. I was not allowed to ask what the meaning was or what they were trying to get at or any kind of nuance. I mean, I was shut down from discussing them by number 13 the night that they gave them to me. Mm-hmm. So, but I did respond to them as best I could. Two of them I said were okay suggestions, but I didn't believe it was the time to do them. Two of them I agreed to do. I thought they were appropriate, and I agreed to do them. And two of them I did not agree to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, immediately after I finished, they wanted to have a meeting to talk about what they were going to do about my response. So I was asked to leave the room for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then they would talk about my response to their suggestions. And like 70, 75 minutes later, it was well over an hour later, they finally came and got me. And when they got me, the church visitors were back in the room as well. And they announced to me that I was going to be suspended for 3 weeks. They weren't really clear about the grounds of suspension. And I didn't have the copy of the church order with me. I didn't know about getting the concurrence of a neighboring council. I didn't know anything about that. And I was just stunned. I thought, where is this coming from? And on what basis are they going to do this? But I thought it would be futile. I mean, I didn't even think about trying to argue. You know, I just agreed to it. So I was told by Keith Manis that I should be peaceable and humble and not attend church for the next 3 weeks. So I was effectively banished from my church while this was going on. But of course, the suspension, the 3 week suspension was kind of a ruse anyway. It was kind of phony because they were only doing it because they wanted to get rid of me, or because number 13 wanted to give me an Article 17.
Right, they were buying time.
Yeah, they wanted me suspended and out of the way while they did that. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, the 3 week suspension was kind of phony baloney, but. You know, whatever, huh?
Well, they probably didn't know how long it was going to take them to get the paperwork together because they needed somebody else to do it for them.
Yeah, they probably had to do the information gathering. I don't know how far down the road 13 was with it all at that point. But in any event, the suspension really took me by surprise. I had no idea that was coming. I didn't even know they had the right to do that. And some others have flat out said that they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And have taken the position that was really inappropriate. But well, but anyway, they did. Oh, are you going to say something?
Yeah, sorry. What in theory was the cause for it or the grounds that night? Was it because...
I think they said, they put in the minutes a breakdown in communication.
Because you said no to one-third of the suggestions.
Yeah, I guess so. But see, even that, even the... the nomenclature or describing it as a breakdown in communication, it's not really accurate.
Mm-hmm. It was a disagreement.
I mean, yeah. You could have a disagreement, but it really wasn't a breakdown in communication.
Mm-hmm.
But see, when you're not allowed to discuss or to, you're not allowed to discuss what the issues are or to get them on the table and even negotiate, when that's all short-circuited, then you don't really know what's going on or what the problems are. Or even, like I said, there was no forum to discuss what they were getting at in their suggestions.
Right. Well, even those were probably a ruse. It may have been that if you'd covered yourself in sackcloth and ashes and groveled and asked for pardon and agreed to everything at the outset and just begged them to tell you what to do, maybe they would have let you stay on. But, you know, that was probably a trap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not clear. I mean, I actually heard them putting together this list just before the council meeting of October 6th. I had heard them outside the council room. I walked in. I didn't even know they were meeting, but that's when it was put together. And it was handed to me, as I told you before, it was handed to me on two blank sheets of white paper. It was written in pencil. So they didn't even meet, talk about it, type it up, make sure of what they wanted and what they were saying. And even when they read it to me that night, I mean, they read it to me off this pencil written, you know, white paper. And as it was read to me by the clerk, it wasn't clear. It wasn't written clearly, and they weren't even sure what they meant by what they said on some of them. So it was ill-conceived, and it wasn't thought through. But what should have happened is, like, one of them is they wanted me to be available for counseling or to be welcoming or something to that effect. And so there should have been a discussion do people feel unwelcome, or do they people feel I'm unapproachable, or, you know, who's saying that, or how big of a problem is this, or how do we address this?
Right.
There should have been a discussion of the problem or the perceived problem. It shouldn't have been handled the way they did it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and then there's the behavior. You know, you talked about what was that night like. The behavior of Keith Manis, you know, basically siding with the council and green lighting them on their decision to suspend me.
Yeah, and by what authority?
Mm-hmm.
It's all bizarre. Not only that they did this or thought they could do it, but that he took it upon himself to be there and to press his signet ring to it. As if he has that authority, you know, let alone enough familiarity with the situation to know what was advisable.
Well, I had one of the former elders who has since left the church,
mm-hmm.
and had some issues with what they did, but at the time didn't have the courage to stand up to them. But one of those former elders said that those church visitors should have stopped us. Or if this wasn't in accordance with the church order, they should have stood up to us, or they should have prevented it. He felt like they weren't well served because of the church visitors' complicit attitude about it. Because they were complicit, it almost not encouraged them, but I'm not really sure how to put it. It lent support, let's say. It lent support, or it gave approval.
Right.
To what someone the council wanted to do. Like, this is an okay thing to do. Whereas if the church visitors had said, slow down, you know, give this time, think about it, this may not be the way to go. If you want to go this route, there may be consequences for the church. They probably should have tried to walk it back or discourage it. I'm not sure how much, if at all, they tried to discourage them or get them to take another course of action.
Right.
You know, in my judgment, they should have really tried to talk them out of terminating me, because it's always better to say, hey, if the guy takes another call in 2 months, he's out of here, then you can do what you want anyway. You're better off to do that than to fire him.
Right.
I'm not sure they did that.
Not sure it occurred to them. That same former elder you mentioned, who's no longer at the church, he said
yeah.
That was, alternatives were never discussed, never raised. I think he said the option of asking you to leave and take another call was never mentioned, never occurred to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is bizarre, because that's one of the things that the church visitors should have been aware of. They should have been very mindful that's preferred option.
Mm-hmm.
But a termination not only affects the minister and his prospects, his career, but it also affects the church. But of course, now in hindsight, we know that it has a very adversely affected that local church.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's October 27. And then the following week was the night that I got the termination papers, the Article 17. And apparently, between the suspension, the night of the suspension, that following week, there were meetings and more meetings and elder meetings with church visitors and whole council meetings with church visitors. And they must have had three meetings, maybe four. But I was told, a day or two before that Thursday, November 5, I was told by Keith Manis that there was a meeting Thursday night and I better plan to be there. And he couldn't tell me what it was about. Okay. That usually gets a reaction out of people when I tell them that.
Mm-hmm.
When I tell colleagues or other elders now in different churches, there's going to be a meeting, but we're not going to tell you what it's about. Usually get a reaction like, well, that's not really very cool, is it? No. But that's when they gave me my termination papers, and it wasn't a very long meeting. I sort of suspected what it was going to be about.
Right.
But number 13 was very cold. In fact, Emily had written a statement, and she came in and wanted to read that. And I don't remember all the details of what she said, but I remember how it led off. You know, I think we all know what this meeting is about, or something like that. And then she had some rhetorical questions like, what happened? I thought we were friends, kind of thing. And so then when she was done, number 13, just kind of coldly said, okay, thank you. And then on to the business, and then I got my walking papers and the termination agreement, and that was pretty well it.
And all the council was there, and the church visitors as well?
Yeah, yeah. I didn't get the impression that the council really knew what they were doing or what the consequences were, how serious this was, what a career-impacting thing this was, the stigma of an Article 17. I didn't get that impression at all, that they knew how serious it was. And so then that goes back to the church visitors and their dereliction of duty to tell them about that.
And, well, I know from my own conversations with a couple of them that not only did they not realize from a professional standpoint the career impact, but even the personal impact, they didn't have much empathy or understanding of what this sort of dismissal can do to a person, like you said, the stigma, but also the depression and the discouragement, what it's like to be in that position. And at least one of them said, well, certainly he's, you know, talented. He could do something else. You know, has he ever thought about doing this or that? You know, teaching was something that came up. And I thought, would you like someone to take your farm away from you and say, well, he can just go do something else? Mm-hmm. You know, without giving you the resources to make that happen, or, you know, after having besmirched your name and cast a cloud over all your past ministry, well, you know, let's mm-hmm. look on the bright side. He can, now he's got all options.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not a great awareness or depth or even spiritual insight.
Yeah. A very manifest lack of awareness, lack of empathy. No understanding, no realization of what they did, the consequences of it, the fallout personally. And like you said, the way a minister would take it personally, besmirching the reputation, you know, to say nothing of the reputation and the consequences for the church.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Although it's interesting thinking back on that time. I knew that 13 was the architect, but I also knew that it wasn't worth or it wouldn't do you any good trying to appeal to the other guys because they didn't know enough or weren't aware enough to be appealed to. So when I was trying to contact someone, anyone, to try to slow this down or throw something out in front of it, it was the church visitors I appealed to because you could attempt to have a meaningful conversation with them about the consequences or the implications or what was really going on. But of course it was a dead end because they'd already made their minds up. But already I think some of us had a sense that the council didn't really know what they were doing. But
right.
13 did somewhat. He knew it was wrong, but he was willing to speed it up to get what he wanted. But I think Keith Manis was the one who was without excuse because he is sophisticated and because he is an experienced minister, and because he heard from multiple people about what was really going on and refused to hear, or at least refused to change direction.
Well, there's that, and also just the specifics. The Article 17 is a known quantity in the denomination.
Yeah.
There's not a doubt in my mind that he has read articles in the banner or has heard things to the effect that the Article 17 is a black mark on your career.
Right. Well, the title of the article that was published in the early 2000s is Scarlet No More.
Right. Yeah.
I got the feeling
so don't just
right.
Slap it on something.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Right.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
Collegiality.
My way of thinking. Jokers to the right, here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Tell me that the council was at that point. So why wouldn't those church visitors tell me they're thinking about an Article 17 and you may want to come to them and offer to try to take another call somewhere or give yourself like a 3-month probation or tell them that you're going to be taking a position at another church or you're going to be seeing to try to forestall the Article 17. There's no reason why, to my way of thinking, why they couldn't have done that. I don't think that would have been a violation of confidentiality, but you know, there was none of that. There was no collegiality or support for me personally from those guys.
Yeah, that's a shortcoming in itself. I think the one main reason why it wouldn't have occurred to them to do that was because the movers and shakers who were making the decisions already had their minds made up, and the church visitors would have known. If 13 had decided this was the way it was going to be, they'd have had a sense of whether they could change his mind.
Mm-hmm.
But it was especially wrong not to make you aware, because officially you were still smack in the middle of a 3-week suspension. If there was something else going on, you should have been told.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I still think the 3-week suspension and all that still, to me, seems disingenuous. You know, I'm sure they could defend it if they wanted to, but it seemed like I used the word phony earlier in our conversation, but
Well, we've been going for a bit over an hour. Do we want to pause it here and then come back to the special meeting of Classis and how that all came about in the next installment?
Yeah, I suspect that that'll be a shorter answer, because really what that involves is just talking about a couple of the high points, some of the main things that went on, because we weren't privy to the conversation, so I don't think that'll be as involved an answer. But number four, when I tried to talk to Keith Manis, my meeting with him at his church, that might be a little bit of a few minutes anyway to answer that one and talk about that one.
Well, I was thinking we could probably group the next three questions together, three or four.
Sure.
And just kind of keep going in chunks. I thought we'd get through those first couple in half an hour or 40 minutes, but clearly, especially with the early procedural stuff, and people again throwing their weight around, you know, there's a lot to say. So,
well, alrighty then.
Right. So
next time we'll pick it up with D-Day of December 8th, right?
Yep, December 8th of 2015, our anniversary.